Hi, this is ADK from Rambourne Cider Company in Luxembourg. You're listening to Cider Chat.
Episode number 94. Hello and welcome to Cider Chat. My name is Rhea Wincoller, and I am the producer and a cider MC on this weekly podcast where we speak with makers, enthusiasts, and folks within the cider trade from around the world. And this week, we are speaking to Addie Kay from Rambourne Cider Company in Luxembourg. There'll be more on that chat in just a moment. It's the beginning of September in my spot of Ciderville, and the race is on to get out into the orchard and to be checking the ripening stages of the palms out there, just screaming, "Hey, take me, press me, squeeze me." I think that's what they say to me, at least. I've been visiting some amazing orchards, and last Friday was a star-spangled day. I was up once again in a pear tree, and I am thinking that I might have come upon one of the older peri-pear trees in the United States. So I'm just going to hang on to my hat with that one. But I did get up there. This was a tree that I feel like I saved it from the axe last year. And I then felt a duty when I visited it again and saw these little tiny pears all over the place. Of course, I reached up and you turn it horizontally, the stem, and if it clips off, you know it's ripe for the picking. So I did that. I had to borrow, I think it was like a 20-foot apple ladder. I was on that, and in addition, I had like an apple picking pole, a two-tiered one. I had to add on to that, and still I couldn't get to the top of this pear tree. This pear tree has two primary trunks coming out of the ground. It's just amazing. So I'm going to be looking at taking some rootstock and grafting onto that, maybe growing from seed, a whole bunch of different stuff. It just made me so happy. I just have this certain affection to peri-pears, no surprise there, since we have such a celebrity on the podcast here. But there's something about this tree that's just called to me. So I picked it as much as I could. I had to leave the rest of the fruit on the top. It was a little hard to shake because there's so much bramble and some poison ivy underneath that we couldn't really put a canvas cover down to even collect the fruit. It made us work. And, you know, peri-pears are kind of persnickety, if you know one, like I feel like I know one. And they're kind of peculiar that way. So we're leaving the rest of the fruit up there. The main yield I got was not a lot, but I'm going to continue letting it ripen. Then I'm going to freeze the fruit and let it thaw out. And I don't even think I might press it because it's so little fruit, because they're really, really tiny. I mean, really tiny, that I'm just going to ferment it like that, all the pulp and everything. And then I'll strain off from there. That's what I'm thinking. I'm going to do just a wild yeast fermentation and see what I get. I'm just, I feel like, as probably you right now, you know, you've been out in the orchard today, you're going out, or you'll get out there sometime this week. Whenever we go up to these majestic trees, and even the little tiny saplings that are coming, there is a story in each of them and a feeling, a presence of them. I can't help it. That's who I am, and that's what I get from every single tree and any orchardist that I have met along the way in this path in Ciderville has had that same type of connection to the trees. It's really magical, isn't it? I love it. So that's a little bit about what I did this weekend. I spent more time than I probably should have just trying to get that peri-pear, but geez, you know, you save it from the axe and then it bears fruit. You can't walk away from that. And it's going to be a lot of fun. And that's what it's all about in Ciderville. When we return, we're going to start with our first sidebar on palms in art. We'll be right back with that. Oh, 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 oh. I love art in all its forms, and certainly cider making is one of the key art forms out there in the liquid medium. I also enjoy painting myself, and I started that just a couple years ago. My favorite medium is oil on canvas, and what I paint is essentially concentric circles. No surprise there. But I don't really know too much about the art world, so I'm going to start this first edition of Palms in Art by asking you, Ciderville, if you know an art historian who might be specializing in the field that might lend a little bit more info of still life with apples and pears. Do send an email my way for that contact info to Rhea@CiderChat. But for the most part, I am not an art historian. I do not know too much about what's going on there in the museum. And sometimes, frankly, I get bored when I go to the museum. True confession. Maybe you've had that same experience yourself. I want to go there and feel like I'm really enthralled. And typically, I'll go for one particular show. Most recently, I was at Mass MoCA, which is in my spot of Ciderville. It's an amazing, modernistic kind of museum. There's trees growing upside down, which is totally incongruent, about 20 feet up in the air. But that's part of the work they do. I also saw an amazing installation and got to put on virtual reality helmets and fly through the air. That was with an artist called Laurie Anderson. So those in the know who might know Lou Reed, who is now gone, the guy who sang Take a Walk on the Wild Side. He and Laurie Anderson were, I guess, partners at one point. And she is a kind of like a visual artist to a singer. So I go for episodes like that, but I'm not one who really craves going to museums until I decided while we were last at the museum to say, hey, let's find art with palms. And that became our treasure hunt. And that became the sprout of this idea for this here new edition called Palms in Art that I'll be airing on Cider Chat. I thought it was a great idea to incorporate a whole other avenue to get folks who might not know about cider involved in Cider Chat and involved in the story of palms. As we broaden our perspective, I think not only does art help us understand the history and story of a particular character, and in this case, the characters are palms, but also to understand the culture and landscape. And in turn, I do believe that will inform our cider making technique. I just have that feeling. And what a cool thing, because we just so happen to have so many still lives with apples and pears out there done, created by the masters. So this week, although I said last week it was going to be Renoir, well, we're going to save Renoir for now. We're going to go to a different French artist by the name of Paul Cézanne, who I'm sure you have heard about before. And he was considered a post-impressionist painter. Now, I didn't know what that meant, so I looked it up. And it's essentially a French art movement that was developed between 1886 and 1905. So that's around the time that my cider press was developed, too. I have an 1880s cider press. That was a long time ago, and I'd like to imagine that Cézanne was there sipping a cider and doing the still life with apples and pears. What is unique about his work, and I think it kind of is something that we could see a parallel with cider. A single variety cider, an orchard-based cider, really draws you in to the full mouth experience. When you sip on a cider and you're not just going one-dimensional, your palate is saying, wow, what is that? Those notes there I'm tasting, maybe some melon, maybe the terroir, that region that I'm familiar with now. Perhaps there are some spices that are coming up. I'm getting that floral aspect. And you're full on in the apple. There's also ciders that are being made that can be one-dimensional. where you have this center point focus. And that's where I think a lot of the flavor ciders come in, or the ciders that have a fruit addition or some other flavor addition on. Don't get me wrong, I enjoy those, but they can be one-dimensional because your taste buds go immediately to, mango, pineapple. And then the next thought is, where's the apple? And then you start searching around. Well, Cézanne is like that orchard-based cider maker who, from the get-go, your visual goes full out across the whole canvas. And this particular apples and pears, the still life, is not that big. It's approximately like 17 inches by 23 inches. So not big, but big enough. But when you look at it, you're immediately drawn by this tan table, and you see the linear lines going horizontal. And then these two plates, one with to the right with some apples and to the left with pears and a quince. And what he did with his paintings, which was really unique, is that you didn't just go to the center subject. You went to the whole picture. Again, see how that's kind of like an orchard-based cider, that really exquisite boutique cider that people work so hard on that gives you that full broad taste? That's what's happening with his painting too. So that you look at it from the whole perspective, you almost look at it as if you're looking down on top of the table. You're like looking down at the tabletop. Maybe that's another way to say it. Oh, it's going to be interesting for me to learn how to describe paintings. But that is, in essence, what he was known for, that you're drawn into the total landscape and not one center point. And I think that there is a lesson there for us in cider. As I said, are we one-dimensional or are we multidimensional with our cider making, focusing on the apple and all the nuances that it brings to our palate? It's going to take a while to kind of train our palate to notice what's happening in there. You get a dry cider and folks just feel it's bland, but they're not getting that terroir. They're not getting the minerality. They don't understand it. And that's where we're building upon our skills, kind of like I'm building upon my skills with you, learning an appreciation of art that I never had. It's kind of a, you know, life imitating art once again. So very interesting. This painting is viewable at the Met in New York City. So if you go to the new blog, Palms in Art at ciderchat.com, you'll get the info there. You'll get to see a photo of this painting. You could also see it on Twitter at Palms in Art and on Instagram at the same handle, Palms in Art. And this week's Palms in Art was brought to you by the Talking Palms, our favorite fruit when you need a good cider or pear. If you're interested in sponsoring Palms in Art, just go to ciderchat.com, the sponsorship page. We'll be right back with our main chat with Rambourne Cider in Luxembourg. Oh, 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 oh. One of the beauties about a Cider Chat podcast here is that we get to delve into parts of the world that we may never have visited. It might be on our bucket list, but we just haven't gotten there yet. And so it goes with this week at the cidery called Rambourne Cider Company, located in the country of Luxembourg. Now, before we get to the cidery, let me tell you a little bit about Luxembourg so you could kind of wrap your mind around it. Luxembourg is in Europe. It is landlocked. That means it does not border any ocean waters or sea. To the west is the country of Belgium. To the south is France. And to the east is Germany. And I'm sure that there's a lot of influence of all those different foods and libations coming in there. Just kind of wrap your mind around these dimensions. From north to south, it is 51 miles long or 82 kilometers. 51 miles long. Okay, imagine that. And from east to west, it's 35 miles wide or 57 kilometers. 51 miles long and 35 miles wide. That's amazing, right? The population is hovering somewhere around 500,000. Put that in perspective, North Dakota, which is a heck of a lot longer, it's, well, I'm going to say it's about, probably from east to west, it's probably about 600 miles long. That has a population of about 700,000 people, not near a million either. But this is an amazing country. I think it has one of the highest per capita per person in Europe. So it's considered like one of the richest countries in the EU. I hope all the folks feel that way too. It also has a population that's very international. Unlike what I've found going to Europe, you could have a very homogeneous country where everyone is primarily of, in the Netherlands, all Dutch, and you have a major Indonesian influence there. But for the most part, pretty homogeneous. But not so much for Luxembourg. And that probably lends itself to making it an amazing place to have a cidery, because you're then able to bring in not only traditional aspects, and they're bringing in the traditions from the UK in terms of their approach to cider and their profile of taste, but they're also bringing in what we might call some New World ciders. So I will be speaking more about that, but to just get to the short end of that story, they have a hop cider too, which is not something that you're seeing in those other regional areas such as France or even the Netherlands. We're seeing a little bit of hop cider up there, but the Netherlands is kind of new to the ballgame, much like Luxembourg. So I find that the new regions of hot spots for cider making are the ones that really kind of are stepping out of the box and approaching this from delivering not only an amazing cider, but really a wide palate offering, or a wide really offering cider for a wide and diverse palate. That's probably the better way to say that. So it's a very interesting makeup of that country, and I'm sure we're going to be hearing more as this particular cidery, Ramborn Cider Company, is part of the Cider Going Up campaign page at ciderchat.com. So they're part of a select few who have joined in to help keep this podcast thriving. And if you are in the cider trade or your commercial cidery, you might want to join that too, because it's limited to the first 20 cideries that have helped support this podcast in one way or another, specifically primarily via the Cider Chat Patreon page. So I'm really excited that they just reached out and saw the viability of this podcast. And our guest this week will be talking a little bit about that. So if you have not gotten a glass of cider yet, this would be an excellent time to do that. And if you aren't able to have a glass of cider, well, I hope there's one your way soon. And if you are just driving about or something, well, just kind of, you know, as always, keep your hands on the wheels and your eyes on the road. We're going to begin this chat with Addie Kay of Ramborn Cider Company, where I'm asking him a little bit about the Seattle Cider Summit, which takes place coming up this weekend on September 9th. He is going to be there in Washington State attending that amazing cider fest that's put on by Alan Shapiro. And Alan Shapiro has been on this podcast, so if you want to find out a little bit more about the Cider Summit festivals, do go to episode number 75, and you could hear Alan talk about what he's doing with the Cider Summit, which are festivals that take place primarily all on the West Coast and a little bit in the Midwest, too. So listen along as he tells you a little bit what he's doing, and then we'll get a little bit more of a sense about this cidery. I think it's a really enjoyable chat for me. I so enjoyed the opportunity to be able to have this conversation and to share it with you as we delve into Ciderville around the world. Again, this is Addie Kay of Ramborn Cider Company in Luxembourg.
Part of the trip to Seattle is to kind of sort of see what it's like up there. There's so much energy in the Pacific Northwest around cider. So many kind of passionate people making really interesting drinks out there. So I think part of it's a bit of a mission to kind of see what's behind that and get to know some of the people behind that. Yeah, so you mentioned that we're already distributed in Wisconsin in the Midwest, and I mean that's kind of following some of the, you know, we're from Luxembourg, and the Luxembourgish settlers in the US all ended up in that one corner of the country. So there's a very small town called Belgium, Wisconsin, where there's lots and lots of Luxembourgish heritage there, and so it's kind of really following that settler's route, and it's been really interesting seeing our cider being enjoyed there by people who are wanting to kind of reconnect with some of that Luxembourgish heritage that's a lot harder to access maybe than some of the other more prominent European heritage that is kind of gets a lot of attention in the US.
How would you distinguish a citizen who came from Luxembourg, and what is the language like? Luxembourgish is how you refer to it. Is it a blend of like German and French and Flemish?
It's a dialect of German would be the easiest way of describing it. Luxembourgish is the language. I love it. I'm learning a little bit as I work here. Mostly a Brit. I was born in Canada. I'm kind of from all over, half Italian, lots of mixed up heritage, which is kind of perfect for being in Luxembourg. You know, half the population of this country are not from Luxembourg. There's lots of Brits here, lots of Portuguese here, lots of French and Germans and Belgians, but also some Americans, Australians. People from all over the world coming here, really. A very small country, so about 500,000 people in total. The Luxembourgish people are, an amazing people. They have a strong sense of who they are, and I'm not really sure how I would describe it, really. I mean, there's some interesting different perspectives you get from asking people, you know, what it means to be Luxembourgish. Carlo, the CEO of Ramborn, somebody asked him this from the English language magazine here in Luxembourg, and his response was being Luxembourgish means deciding who you're going to cheer for in an international competition. Luxembourg's probably not going to be in the World Cup anytime soon. So, I don't know, they're looking pretty good in them. But you know, you need to kind of be ready to adopt another language in another country in those situations. Another one I heard recently was somebody who's been involved with Ramborn from the start was talking to somebody who came to visit us, and he said, well, you know, we've got the quality of food of the French with the portions of the Germans.
I thought
that was the best way of saying that.
Yeah. That gives us a nice overview. I mean, it just sounds like such a fascinating country, and I do have a friend who lives there, and it's certainly on my list to get there. And your cidery is like the first commercial cidery in a long time, or is there like a big tradition of cider making in Luxembourg?
So, yeah, it's kind of, I guess that's another complicated thing. There's two sides of it, really. Yeah, it's the first commercial cidery. It's the first kind of cidery making English-style cider at all. But it kind of the main project that we have here is to revive this tradition of cider making that goes back as far as the Romans, really, at least as far as the Romans. There's some suggestion that it goes back further to the Celts who are here, but that's harder to find written record of. Certainly that as far back as the Romans. The Luxembourgish word for cider is fiets, which comes from the Latin fiets of vinum, second wine. So it was the first wine would be from the grapes, and then you'd use the same equipment to press a second wine, which would be from the apples in the region.
And that's spelled V-I-E-Z, is that correct?
Exactly, yes.
So they wouldn't really recognize in the country there the word cider as we spell it in the States as C-I-D-E-R. Is that right?
They would recognize it from the French mainly. Mm. And as I said, there's a large population of expats here. So, there's some of the main kind of industrial cider brands are familiar to people here. So Bulmers, Magners, Strongbow, certainly. And mm-hmm. And then also you have lots of Portuguese people here in Luxembourg, so they're familiar with brands like Somersby and so on. Also from the French, so Cidre, people are familiar with this, especially the French-speaking population, the French people who are here will know that. But then, you know, that's quite a different product from the kind of sparkling, refreshing English-style cider. I think that it's an interesting kind of microcosm of what's going on around the world in cider, which as interest in cider is growing, so is the need to kind of help people understand and be introduced to the vast variety that cider can include as a word.
Right. Yeah, super exciting right now. And I imagine that folks are really, you know, kind of looking your way locally. It sounds like you work with a lot of orchards in the region. You would consider the cidery to be an orchard-based cidery. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, in as much as we work with kind of over 100 different farmers. I mean, we only use apples from, you know, the technical term standard trees, so large trees. We don't plant any bush orchards. And that's mainly just the culture here has always been for farmers to have a certain number of these very large trees on their land, kind of whatever else is going on. They'll have some apple trees or some pear trees. Yes, we actually, there's some orchards you can walk through, sort of a 5 kilometer walk you can do around where our farm is by the German border here. And you can see all the kind of old trees that we have here and the new plantations of standard trees that we put down. And again, using just these traditional varieties that grow from the region. We're not planting any kind of supermarket varieties of fruit, and we're not planting any intensive dwarfed trees. It's orchard based, but we work with lots of fruit that's not grown by ourselves. Mm-hmm. So I guess it's a little complicated to understand because those trees are, you know, large. They're dotted all over the country, and they produce a lot of fruit. And you know, over the last 100 years or so, there's the need, the kind of use of that fruit has declined very, very quickly. And we've ended up with a lot of fruit that would have otherwise just gone kind of rotting. Nobody knew what to do with the fruit, or if they did, they didn't. There was no need to press, you know, tens of thousands of litres of feets from these varieties that aren't really useful for much else. So to kind of help find ways of using that in a way that can be enjoyed by lots of people looking to discover cider has been really fun and I think added value to a lot of that land where people were, every autumn, just fields full of rotting apples.
Right. It's really exciting, I'm sure, for the local orchardists and the farmers. Now, you have this profile of doing that more traditional farmhouse style. You also have a perry. I know you do distillation. Mm. And we're going to have a follow-up podcast on all this. I make contact with Wouter at Cider Cider in Rotterdam, who will be visiting you I'm not sure if you'll be there when he visits, but we'll be visiting the site.
I won't actually. No, it's unfortunate timing. He's going to be around. Carlo's going to give him a tour of what we're doing here. Yeah, he's coming on, I think, on Sunday or Monday morning.
Right.
I'll still be gone, but yeah.
Perfect. And so we did connect, and so I'll be stopping at Cider Cider in Rotterdam on the way down. hopefully getting some of the Ramborn to taste. I'm really excited about that. But I noticed that you have this like cacophony of different ciders that you're making, including a hop cider. And that, of course, caught my attention because, you know, you're doing a little bit of the new world style or modern style is one of the phrases people look at that, or just plain hop cider. Of course, that's being done in the UK too. Mm. And just a little bit about that, and you're going to be heading to the Northwest again to the Cider Summit in Seattle. You must be, you know, on the verge of kind of like bringing in a lot of different cider traditions. And is that the focus, to kind of have it be a broad range so that it's approachable to a wider palate, or just to stay on the cutting edge of what cider's happening?
Mm-hmm. So part of it's about being on the cutting edge, but it's I think you hit closer to the mark with this kind of breadth of appeal. You know, part of the reason perhaps that the fruit has gone unused from some of those really traditional trees is that you can make some very challenging drinks, which, you know, some of which I'm a great fan of, that fall under the umbrella of cider. But I think what's really helped revive the trees here and keeping, you know, starting seeing people plant new trees of these old varieties, is having something that many people, not just people who are really interested in getting deep into the cider world, but casual drinkers, getting them interested in cider. And part of that is, so hopped cider helps introduce what we're doing here to people who are showing a little bit of interest in you know, going for higher quality drinks. And that's what craft beer has done for the beer industry. So, it seems like a natural fit. Also, seeing people in the US experiment a little bit with hop ciders and seeing that doing well. We started off extremely small. We did a few 30-liter batches with a few different kinds of hops to see what would work with the type of apples we have here. And we found a couple that worked better than others. And I think we'll be scaling that up slowly to a full product. At the moment, it's kind of part of our special our cellar editions range of smaller batches. Going to Seattle obviously is a bit of a pilgrimage in terms of hops to be in Washington State, but it's a fine line, isn't it? Because if you go too far down the hop cider route or focusing on flavors, I find, you know, perhaps it's distracting from the apple, which for us has to be the essence of cider. You'll notice that's kind of one of the only, it's the only non-apple or pear flavor that's in any of our ciders. And we actually have some quince wine up in the upstairs at the moment, which we're sort of considering what to use for, and we have some aging in barrels below that's really exciting. It's just finding ways to attract people to cider without masking the original apple. That's kind of the balance that we're trying to achieve.
Mm-hmm. And that seems to really fit where you are in the world, because Luxembourg is such an international country, you know, versus some of the other countries around there, are a lot more homogeneous in a way. At least that's been my experience. So I imagine that just think about under 1 million people in a country and folks from all over the world, they're probably a little bit more diversified than you would find regionally outside of the borders. So that's probably really spot on how you're approaching your market in that way.
Yeah, we want to share what Luxembourg is doing with its apples and pears as far as possible. And I think with products, with ciders like we have, and particularly the Perry, actually, the pears that we have here have such high amounts of tannins in, the perry we have is very, very distinctive. And I think there's something in that, that can be shared kind of far and wide, not necessarily in huge volumes, but, you know, taking that drink around the world to tell people what Luxembourg is doing, I think is really, really exciting. So at the moment, we sell at a couple of small shops just over the border in Germany. And we've started this work in the US, in Wisconsin.
That's great.
But at the moment, Luxembourg is most of our sales.
Your market, yeah. That's great. And Ramborn was started by three friends. Are any of them native Luxembourgs or Borgs, I would say? I'm not
all
really
of
sure.
Them.
All
yeah.
of them. Okay. But there is this...
All of them are Luxembourgish, yeah.
Okay. And yet there is this like real UK presence or style that you're approaching it. Is there a reason behind that?
Well, I mean, part of it is, I mean, the UK has been making amazing cider for a very long time, and you know, they've shown you know, amazing skill at you know, making fantastic drinks from apples and pears. It's the perfect place to learn from. You know, the three friends who founded Ramborn, they studied with Peter Mitchell in the UK on his cider making course. And it was in the UK where they kind of rediscovered their own passion for cider and brought that idea back. You know, they were drinking cider in the UK and then kind of realized there was all this unused fruit back home in Luxembourg. And kind of seeing how many people in the UK are drinking cider and enjoying cider. That was the inspiration, really, for reviving that tradition in Luxembourg. So in that sense, it's partly, I don't know, it sounds kind of boring, but, you know, market forces, you know, in the UK, they managed to make cider that's good and that lots of people enjoy. And that kind of kept that excitement around cider alive. You know, pubs all over the UK, you know, pretty much all pubs in the UK are selling cider, some of it more real than others. And there's lots of, you know, discussions and debate around that, which is great that discussion's taken place. So it's just seemed like the perfect place to learn from. And I think seeing in the US, there seem to be similar, you know, pilgrimages to the UK to kind of see what's going on there. With the old varieties in the West Country and so on. I think it's kind of the heartland of cider production. And it's the style that the Ramborn kind of cider project has been based on.
I know you have the cider, you have the perry, you also distill. Are you calling that apple brandy? What do you call that, by the way? Anything that you're distilling?
Eau de vie. Yeah.
And I know you had written to me about the oak barrels, so I want to catch up with that, but I'm going to hold that for a later podcast when we're maybe also speaking to...
Yeah, for sure.
Great. And just for the folks out at the Seattle Cider Summit and that you'll be meeting... Do you have like anything, you know, distinguishing that might kind of, I know you have a beard, you wear glasses, you'll be walking around and introducing yourself.
Yeah, I'm not sure how distinguishing those features. Yeah, I'm not sure how distinguishing those features will be at a cider summit. I've realized this.
A t-shirt,
head, English accent, red beard, and glasses. Maybe a t-shirt, maybe a Czech shirt. But even then, that's basically camouflage at those places. So. If anyone recognizes me from the photo or whatever, then come up and chat. I'm always happy to chat cider with anyone at any time. So, yeah.
Yeah, a wonderful collection of folks and cider makers. It's so happening in the Pacific Northwest. Certainly Washington State and Oregon has been a beacon in many ways. First, it was with coffee and coffee houses, and then it moved east. And then you had the craft beer scene, and a cider is kind of unique because it's really an east to west that, and also in the Midwest of the U.S. too. Of course, in the U.S., you could say it started on the East Coast only because we were colonized on the East Coast first. But what they're doing now there is really great. And their whole Washington Week, Cider Week, is coming right up too. So you're hitting it right on the mark there. You're going to have a ton of fun and meet some amazing people.
I'm really looking forward to it. And I think the work, you know, kind of not just in Seattle, but more broadly, the work that is it Alan Shapiro is doing with the summits. I've been able to follow a few of them remotely, just seeing the kind of discussions that it kickstarts on social media. It's really interesting to see so many people talking about, you know, some finer points or kind of more industry points, or, you know, kind of focusing on different fruit varieties or, different techniques and methods of cider making, and, you know, seeing all these discussions happen, in these little clusters around the U.S. is really inspiring.
I agree. And the nice thing about cider right now, and this used to be true with beer, is that when you go to a cider fest in the U.S., you're pretty much guaranteed to meet the maker there, typically even pouring the cider, which really lends that conversation that you're talking about, because it's such a, you know, it's kind of funny to say it's new. What's old is new again in that way too. But there's such a buzz here in the U.S. and the excitement for both U.S.-based cider, but also what's happening around the world. It's just, it's almost like the cup is like pouring over in the best way possible.
And it's really cool seeing, you know, people like you and lots of other kind of bloggers and journalists now getting involved, writing about cider and helping share, as I mentioned before, the variety of what can be called cider is really an amazing thing.
It certainly is. Mm-hmm. How are you taxed in Luxembourg? Are you, and how are you regulated by the country? Does that dictate what you're doing?
It, hugely, yes. There's something called a regulation for, they call it boisson alcoolique confectionné. So it's basically an anti-alcopop law, but it's done in the form of a tax. So there's a 600 euro per hectolitre tax if you are certified as an alcopop.
Wow.
And the definition for that alcopop is quite tricky to navigate if you were to make. Well, I mean, we had to work a lot with customs to make sure we didn't get classed as an alcopop. And in fact, we've seen other cider makers leave the market, other drinks makers leave the market after being, you know, at risk of this. If we were to put any other fruit in our cider, we would struggle immensely. So it gets very tricky, this regulation around, rightly, for if that's what the country wants to do, keep out alcopops, then this tax will do that very, very effectively. But it catches some of the kind of more modern flavored cider making techniques, even the kind of utmost, you know, with the utmost integrity, using, you know, organic orchard-based fruit or however you want to describe it. It is quite easy to be caught under this regulation without expecting it. You see, we don't have any flavored ciders. So partly that's the regulation, and I guess that's helped keep us kind of on, you know, focused on the apples and pears, which has become a strength, really, taking that limitation and turning it to our benefit. people that don't want sweet things all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, I actually personally find the really, really dry ciders are really refreshing because you don't have any of that sweetness left kind of in the mouth at the end of it.
Yeah, yeah. It's so exciting. That's all. It's so exciting.
Yeah, it's cool.
Well, I could talk to you all day, but I'm going to get this recording
for sure.
Edited and let you go and get a little bit of rest from both sides of the coin. And I'll be following your social media as you're overseas here, and we'll contact on the flip side of all this.
Yeah, no, I'm really looking forward to it. And I'm glad we could help out sponsoring what you're doing, because I think, yeah, we're seeing it. There's, you know, there's people here, Natalia doing Cider Explorer in Germany. There's Andy May, the cider sleuth in the UK. You know, Gabe Cook, the ciderologist mm-hmm. guy. You know, there's so many people kind of really working hard now. And you've been at the forefront of that. You've been doing Cider Chat for ages now. You know, the first one I listened to was your interview with Tom Oliver, which that must have been a year ago,
yeah.
18 months ago.
Yeah, it was 2016. So yeah, early on there.
Yeah.
Talking about hop ciders,
so,
actually.
You know, exactly. Yes. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I mean, it's amazing that so many people who aren't directly involved in kind of making and selling cider are helping spread the word and keep those discussions going, keep those debates going. I love it. It's really, really cool. Yeah, it's just now we're hoping to get Luxembourg on the map in those discussions.
Thanks again to Addie Kay of Rembourne Cider Company in Luxembourg. Very exciting to hear what is happening in this country and the collaboration that's happening with Orchardis and some of the really local varieties of apples, their single variety cider, and getting an understanding of how things are taxed. All that just fills my cup. I'm just loving to hear how each region of the world is approaching cider. And these folks here at Rembourne Cider, they have both that local vision and that world view. If you see them at Cider Summit, do go up and say hi. Even if it's only, hey, hi, Addie, I met you via Cider Chat. You know, welcome. And raise a glass and have a little cheer there. And then you can move on to your next tasting, because it's going to be a busy day coming up. A lot of links in this week's show notes, so do check it out for episode number 94. A big tip of the glass to the folks who are patrons of this here podcast, which helps me cover some of the costs for getting this podcast out to you, Ciderville. If you're interested in becoming a patron, just go to Patreon page for Cider Chat. There's a link in the show notes and at ciderchat.com. You could support this podcast for as little as $3 a month, and that $3 goes a heck of a long way. And thank you to the following commercial cideries who are part of the Cider Going Up campaign page at ciderchat.com. That is Current Cider of Percussie, Pennsylvania, and Big Fish Cider Company in Monterey, Virginia, and, of course, this week's guest, Rembourne Cider Company in Luxembourg. Whenever you're out and about, ask for these makers, and by supporting them, you support Cider Chat. I hope between now and next week, you get outside to smell the palms. And if you're in the city and you're feeling like, how can I connect with palms? Well, just do a little search and you'd be surprised on how many groups are out there foraging apples and making community cider. Whether it's in the US, in the UK, in Japan, Australia, around the world, there's something to be had for everyone in Ciderville. This is Rhea Windcaller signing off for now. I'm looking forward to seeing you in Ciderville.
Yeehaw!